Hello everyone, my name is Elijah Bitter, and this is the 12th Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation, Mount Alexander at the 12th hour in Elgin, Texas. Today is May 30, 2024, it's the 23rd day of Sivan, 2028. We will start our second service today with a song, and then we'll do the part two of the second trumpet there in final warning track of track number 5 of Vicky Holler. Revelation 8, 8 and 9. The second trumpet and the second angel sounded, and as it were a great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea, and the third part of the sea became blood, and the third part of the creatures which were in the sea and had life died, and the third part of the ships were destroyed. As the fulfillment of the first trumpet brings us up until and including the flood, the time of the second trumpet must therefore be sought in the first post-flood destruction, meaning after the flood, the first destruction after the flood, preceded by a message, and to locate its beginning, we need only to reason that since scripturally a mountain represents a church or a kingdom, Zechariah 8:3, Isaiah 2:3, then the great mountains being enveloped in fire, as was the bush from which Yahweh spoke to Moses, Exodus 3:2, can mean only that Yahweh's presence was then in the midst of and round about his people. And at that time they were, we know, the Israelite movement, the first post-flood church with a message, the ceremonial system, leading this mighty army of the Yeshua, went the pillar of the fire before, and shearing it, followed the pillar of the cloud behind. After the mountain was a fire, it was cast into the sea. The sea, the storehouse of the waters, represents the original abode of the peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues, Revelation 17:15. Hence, while it stands for the world as a whole, the place wherein the nations' waters reside, it definitely localizes the place wherein the church mountain appears. This is borne out by the prophet's words, "Sing unto the Yeshua's a new song, and his praise from the end of the earth, ye that go down to the sea, where the world originated, Palestine, and all that is therein, Israel," or Isaiah 42:10. Bear in mind that only the third part of the sea, the world, became blood. Also that the Israelite movement reached only a part of their world in a symbolical term. The third part of the sea, there was a heathen with whom the movement came into the close contact, especially in the Promised Land. Very obviously then, the mountain is symbolical of the Old Testament church. When the mountain, the church was cast into the sea, and the third part of the sea became blood, the third part of the creatures which were in the sea and had life died. For the blood again represents mortal life. This being so, then it follows that the third part of the sea, the world, which became blood, life, was that portion into which the mountain was cast, and to which Yahweh's people were brought. Accordingly, that portion, Palestine, became a life-saving refuge under those who fully united with the movement, but a shambles for those who did not, just as the Noah's Ark was a life-saving refuge unto those who entered in, but an agent of destruction unto those who remained outside. Concerning the third part of the creatures that died, the Bible would be in guilt of the gross superfluity to say that they had life if by that it meant mortal life. For how could they have died unless they had mortal life? Hence they were figurative only of those living who were privileged to have eternal life, and who once embraced it, but who later, through wickedness, lost it. Thus only a symbolical third part of all who had eternal life, but who sinned it away, died, were destroyed. Thus only a symbolical third part of all who had eternal life, but who sinned it away, died, were destroyed. Revelation 8:9, last part. And the third part of the ships were destroyed. The sea being symbolical of the old world, the ships must accordingly be figurative of the objects which were supposed to shelter and to convey people, and which, though promising to transport them safely over the sea, that's the world, failed to reach the shore beyond. They consequently can portray only their heathen religion and their temples, which offered to their adherents transport to a world hereafter, but not seaworthy. They met with a disaster while in the voyage. Just read that last two words again. They met with the disaster while in the voyage. Both they and their temples were destroyed by the Israelites in response to the command of the Yeshua. He shall utterly destroy all the places, temples, the ships, wherein the nation which you shall possess serve their gods upon the high mountains and upon the hills and under every green tree, and ye shall overthrow their altars and break their pillars and burn their groves with the fire, and ye shall hew down the graven images of their gods and destroy the names of them out of that place. Deuteronomy 12, 2 and 3. In another instance, under a different set of the circumstances, when the church is figuratively passing over the land instead of over water, church and the place of the ships are used to symbolize the church. See tract number 2, the one in paradox. Okay, it says, and they're perfectly fitting, respectively, the first two periods of the ancient world. The first two trumpets give a warranty that the succeeding periods are also perfectly symbolized by the succeeding trumpets. The truth, therefore, concerning the third period is symbolized by the third trumpet, Revelation 8, 10, and 11. And the third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from the heaven, burning as it were a lamp, and it fell upon the third part of the rivers and upon the fountains of the waters. Falling from the heaven, the star clearly shows that it can only represent some sort of the heavenly object descending to the earth. For its burning as a lamp is indicative of an object having intrinsic power to give light, and the only such light-bearing object coming from heaven and is the word. Thy word corroborates the psalmist, is a lamp under my feet and a light under my path. Psalms 119:105. And since the star falls only upon the third part of the rivers, nations, Revelation 17:15, it reveals itself as symbolical of the Old Testament scriptures, where it was the Old Testament scriptures that were not at that time accessible unto all the nations, rivers of the earth, but only unto a portion, a symbolical, not actual third part of them. Though upon the rivers the star fell on the third part only, it lit upon all the fountains of the waters. For this fact shows that the Old Testament scriptures fell into the hands of the two classes of people, rivers and fountains. The former one represents the nations which came in close contact with the Bible. These are such as the waters of the river, strong and many, even the king of the Assyria, Isaiah 8:7. For the latter represents the chosen people, the 12 tribes of the Israel, and whom his word was the waters of life, making them living fountains. Thus, he that believeth on me, declared the Yahshua himself, out of his belly shall flow rivers of the living water. John 7:38. And the fountain of Jacob shall be upon a land of corn and wine, Deuteronomy 33:28. Revelation 8:11, and the name of the star is called Wormwood, and the third part of the waters became wormwood, and many men died of the waters because they were made bitter. A bitter and aromatic herb, wormwood, acts both as a cathartic and as a tonic. Qualities and virtues, the significance of which must discover the symbolic meaning of the name wormwood. A cathartic being something possessing purging and cleansing virtues. The name wormwood must therefore, first of all, denote a purging agent. And as the word of Yahweh has the power to purge away the cause and effects of the spiritual debility and to restore healthy function and tone to the sin-sick soul, it obviously is the only such agent which, in this connection, the name wormwood fittingly symbolizes. Consequently, the bitter's cathartic and tonic virtues denotes that the word of Yahweh, though indeed a bitter to one's carnal taste, is to the honest who love it for the good it will do them, purify their heart and soul, their sweetest joy, whereas to the dishonest whose carnal taste is their God and who love not the truth, the word is as gall to their taste, and doubly so it is because they love above the ways of salvation the ways of the world, and these it condemns. For the herb's aromatic quality reveals that those who eat the word of the Yahweh, be it ever so bitter to their carnal taste, will find it the surpassing aroma of the heavenly influence, which will cause them to breathe out a savor of life unto life. Each revealing progressively momentous truth, the first three trumpets indicate that the remaining four trumpets, approaching nearer in turn, the period for the benefit of which the cumulative lessons of the entire symbolism were given, ought to reveal increasingly still more momentous lessons. And precisely this is what the student of the subject will find as he now enters upon the study of the fourth trumpet. Revelation 8:12, and the fourth angel sounded, and the third part of the sun was smitten, and the third part of the moon, and the third part of the stars, so as the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise. Having affected the stars, the moon, and the sun, a symbolization of an entire solar system upon which life depends, for its existence, the action disclosed in these verses shows that this heavenly subject represents something without which all earthly life would cease to exist. Without the Spirit, they must therefore, in this sitting, depict the Church of Yahweh, the light and life of the world. This chance that apparently clear is the twofold lesson that only for the sake of the Church does the world today stand. And that without its light and vitalizing energy, life upon the earth would become extinct as quickly as it would if the sun and the moon should withdraw their influence from the earth. Seeing, however, that the interpretation herein is based not only upon the logic, but also upon the scriptures themselves, under them, we turn for the final word in the present connection. And this we find in the Joseph's dream and its interpretation. And behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars, said Joseph, made obeisance unto me. And his father rebuked him and said unto him, what is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves unto thee to the earth? Genesis 37:9-10. In Jacob's time, his family was number one, the repositories of the unwritten word of the Yahweh. Number two, as the holy temple, and number three, as the congregation of the saints. Being all three, it was therefore the living Church of Yahweh. Jacob accordingly interpreted the sun, moon, and stars as symbolical of his household, the light of the world then, and the fact that the father, the mother, and the 12 sons comprised the Church at that time is conclusive evidence in the proof that the sun, the moon, and the stars are figurative of the Church of Yahweh in three parts, the first of which is here symbolized by the smitten sun. For the great illuminating and vitalizing physical force of the entire solar system, the sun obviously figures forth the word of Yahweh and the Church. The great spiritual fight giving, a light giving, and life sustaining force in the world. Consequently, its being smitten showed that the Church's light for the time being was dim. And this leads us on sequentially and the symbolism for the smitten moon and stars, reflecting the light of the sun, where the sun cannot emit it. The moon accordingly symbolizes the Church sending forth the message light from the world sun to this dark world. This symbolical interdependence between moon and sun shows that without the Church, the word itself cannot shine upon the earth. And since the light from the word sun is symbolized with the ceremonial system, which could not be carried on without a special structure, the moon is therefore symbolical of the tabernacle and of the temple, by which the light of the message of sacrificial service was reflected. This being true, then the stars are obviously figurative of the church membership, and hence the sighting of them along with the sun and the moon symbolically reveal a punishment upon the ancient Israel, but only a third part of them was smitten. So it follows that the Israelite nation falls into three parts, one of which was smitten, and as the nation's history embraces three distinct periods, first from the Exodus from Egypt to the possession of the Promised Land, second from the occupation of the Promised Land to the captivity in Babylon, and third from the deliverance from the Babylon to the advent of the Yahshua. Therefore, during one of these periods, they were smitten. From the interpretation of these three solar symbols, sun, moon, and stars, not to be gainsaid, for the fourth trumpet is seen for the revealing of the punishment that came upon the Jewish nation in the period of their king. For it was in these days that the temple, its service, and its the people were smitten. That is, the nation stars were taken into the Babylonian captivity, the temple moon destroyed, and the service sun abolished for a period of time. Thus resulted the spiritual darkness in the earth, as is depicted by the darkness of the third part of the day and of the night. This great ruin was brought about by the Jewish leaders because they mocked the messengers of Yahweh and despised his words and misused his prophets until the wrath of the Yahweh rose against his people, so there was no remedy. Therefore, he brought upon them the king of the Chaldees, that's Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, who slew their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary and had no compassion upon the young man or maiden, old man, or him that stooped for age. He gave them all into his hand, and they burnt the house of Yahweh and broke down the wall of the Yahushua, and burnt all the palaces thereof with the fire, and destroyed all the goodly vessels thereof. And them that had escaped from the sword carried he away to Babylon, where they were servants unto him and his sons until the reign of the kingdom of Persia, for the fulfilling of the word of the Yahweh, 2 Chronicles 36:16-17, 19:20, and 21. And they slew the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes, and put out the eyes of Zedekiah, and bound him with fetters of brass, and carried him to Babylon, 2 Kings 25:7. So, because the religious services, the temple building, and the nation were smitten, the light which once shone through them was extinguished for more than 70 years until the temple was rebuilt and the sacrificial services reestablished. Manifestly, therefore, the day that portion of the earth where the light of the sun directly shines stands for the promised land, and the night, that portion of the earth where the light of the sun is reflected by the moon and the stars, stands for the heathen land. That when the nation was taken into captivity and the sacred vessels were removed and then left in a state of destitute, a spiritual darkness descended everywhere. This truth is borne out by the parallel physical truth from which the symbolism derives, that in a day and a night the earth makes a complete revolution on its axis, its every inch being darkened sometime within the 24 hours involved. Correspondingly, the symbolism shows that the religious system of the ancient Israel was the only spiritual light in all the ancient world, and Israel itself as the only church recognized by the author of the scriptures. What a momentous truth today for a sectarian Christendom. Let it admonish all who choose to walk in the light to avoid the mistakes of others. Avoid the mistakes of others? Oh, how terrible the thought of the closing of the heart and thereby turning a deaf ear unto the pleadings of the Spirit of the Yahweh. Think what great sorrow and suffering could have been averted had men not been so hardened in the pride and self-conceit. It was too humiliating for those leaders in the Israel of old to acknowledge their mistakes and receive correction. And the Yahweh's humble servants, the prophets. But the ignoring of the truth did not perpetuate their exaltation in the eyes of the people, as they had expected it to. Neither did they killing the prophets make right their error or cover their sins, nor did it silence Yahweh. But rather, in the course of time, exposed their utter ignorance and uncovered their shame before the whole world. Should Yahweh's people at this time repeat the mistakes of the Jews, then the punishment decreed in the words, "There shall be weeping and gnashing of the teeth," Matthew 24:51, would fail to find an intensity is parallel in any age. For a full realization, moreover, simply of the disappointment of being on the very verge of the stepping into the paradise, but failing short, falling short, and finding oneself instead plunged into hell, would be enough to stab one through and through with the most anguishing remorse. Let us therefore open wide our hearts as we read the Yeshua's pitying plea. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them which are sent unto thee. How often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wing, and ye would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. Matthew 23:37-38. for the Yahshua's voice crieth unto the city, and the man of wisdom shall see thy name. Hear ye the rod, and who hath appointed it? Micah 6:9. And for the failure to hear his voice, remember that the Yahweh may smite, whereas men cannot. Just as it is impossible for any being aside from Yahweh to injure the heavenly planet, so likewise it is impossible, the symbolism reveals, for anyone to injure. For the church, when she is fully surrendered unto Yahweh, and consequently under his protection, thus symbolically he assures his people that he does not allow to come upon them any evil but that which they themselves invite, and which for their good he may permit. Behold, says the psalmist, he that keepeth Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep. Psalms 121:4. For he that touches you touches the apple of his eye. Zechariah 2:8. By many of the Yahweh's servants were these promises realized. Notably, there was the instance when the Exodus movement reached the Red Sea, and later the River Jordan, and both bodies of the water rose up upon a heap to afford the people a safe passage and to destroy their enemies. Also, when the three Hebrews were delivered from the fiery furnace, Daniel from the lion's den, Mordecai and his people from the execution, instigated by the Haman, and Elijah from the hand of Ahab, and Jezebel. Indeed, if you have faith as a grain of the mustard seed, as the Savior declares, you shall say unto this mountain, remove hence to yonder place, and it shall remove, and nothing shall be impossible unto you. Matthew 17:70. Although the wicked bring the woes, Revelation 8:13. And I beheld and heard an angel flying through the midst of the heaven, saying with a loud voice, woe, woe, woe unto the inhabitants of the earth by the reason of the other voices of the trumpet of the three angels which are yet to sound. For the last three of the seven trumpets, being woe trumpets, unlike the first four, some great change obviously is to take place between the first four and the last three. Having up to this point brought us to the destruction of the first temple and on to the building of the second, the prophetic word of the Yahweh leads us on now to the first advent of the Yahshua and to his crucifixion. The next great events associated with the trumpet, and these events ushering in the Old Testament era, ushering of the Old Testament era out, and the new one in, disclosed that the last three trumpets embrace the history of the New Testament period. The woes consequently point first unto Satan's persecuting
of the faithful in his endeavor to keep them from the embrace of Christianity, and second, to his persecuting the heathen in his endeavor to Christianize them. The first woe comes with the fifth trumpet, Revelation 9, 1 to 12. Okay, so we start with Revelation 9, verse 1 through 4 first. And the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fall from the heaven unto the earth. And to him was given the key of the bottomless pit. And he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit as the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened by the reason of the smoke of the pit, and there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth, and unto them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power, and it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of the Yahweh in their forehead. Taking in order the parts, the star, the key, the pit, the smoke, the darkness, and the locust of this fifth trumpet symbolism, we come first to the star. Just as did the star of the third trumpet, so this fifth trumpet star descended from heaven to earth. And as the third trumpet star has been conclusively identified as a representing the advent of the Bible, then this latter one, since it is similar to the former, must stand for something the equivalent of it. For the Bible and Yahshua have been complementary affinities, each the word of Yahweh. And John 1:1-14, then the fact that the descent of the first star is symbolical of the advent of the Bible compels the conclusion that the descent of the second star is symbolical of the first advent of the Yahshua. Moreover, the star is personified as him, masculine in the gender, thus being limited to a male person. And finally, Yahshua himself gives testimony that he is the bright and morning star, Revelation 22:16. To him, be it remembered, was given the key of the bottomless pit. And I saw an angel come down from the heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit, and a great chain in his hand, and he laid a hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years, Revelation 20, verse 1 and 2. As the Yahshua is the one who secures Satan's captivity, thereby ushering in the millennium, he alone can be fittingly symbolized by the angel having the key of the bottomless pit, and by the star to whom the key was given. And as the giving of a thing to any certain one must precede the having of it by that one, the verbs given, Revelation 9:1, and having, Revelation 20, verse 1, and 1 and 18, point of two different times. Obviously, therefore, Yahshua received the key at the sounding of the fifth trumpet, sometime before the millennium. Hence, at the commencement of the millennium, he already has it. Yahshua's mission being to bring deliverance from the prison house of the sin and of death the bottomless pit, and to do so through the preaching of the gospel. The key, therefore, must be figurative of the gospel, or the teaching of the plan of salvation of the blood of the everlasting covenant of Yahshua, Hebrews 10, 19 and 20, the new and living way, as the only power that is able to set free those who are imprisoned in the bottomless pit. Since the bottomless pit of the Revelation 20, verse 3 is symbolical of the earth as a prison house during the millennium, then the bottomless pit of Revelation 9:1, being identical, must likewise be symbolical of the earth as a prison house at another time. This implicitly biblical interpretation of the star, the key, and the bottomless pit reveals that the earth at the Yahshua's first advent had become a prison house, a pit for Yahweh's people, and that Yahshua came to open it in order to save them. The very fact that Yahweh's people are vested with the power to keep open the bottomless pit, then should they be defeated, the pit would be shut and would become a prison house from which there would be no escape unless it be reopened. And so Satan, in the latter days of the Jews, as the sacred history records, attacked them, took them captive, and thus shut the pit. And knowing that when the Savior should come, he would open it, the dragon therefore stood ready to devour the child as soon as it was born, Revelation 12:4. But losing sight of the infant Yahshua, he incited her to slay all the children that were in Bethlehem and in all the coasts thereof from 2 years old and under, Matthew 2:16, in the hope of making rid of the Savior under the protection of the providence. However, Yahshua was kept from the bloody hand of Herod. Then, subsequently, with the gospel key, he opened the pit and freed his people. This he himself avowed. The Spirit of Yahshua he declared is upon me, because he hath anointed me to preach the plan of the salvation, the blood of the everlasting covenant of the Yahshua, Hebrews 10, 19, and 20, the new and living way unto the poor. He hath sent me for the healing up of the brokenhearted, for the preaching of deliverance unto the captives, and for the recovering of the sight unto the blind, for the setting at liberty them that are bruised, for the preaching of the acceptable year of the Yahshua, Luke 4:18-19. And as a result of the opening of the pit, there came the smoke, the darkness, and the locust. Revelation 9:2. And he opened a bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit as the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by the reason of the smoke of the pit. For the significance of the smoke, we need look no further than unto the ceremonial system, which was a compacted prophecy of the gospel, or the teaching of the plan of the salvation of the blood of the everlasting covenant of Yahshua, Hebrews 10, 19 and 20. The Acts of the Apostles, 6th part, quoted page 14. There we behold the ascending smoke of the ceremonial offering that, as we know, prefigured the Yahshua's great sacrifice in the behalf of the human race. Accordingly, the smoke which came from the pit is symbolical of Yahshua's crucifixion, and the darkened sun and air are symbolic of the darkness over the whole land from the sixth hour until the ninth hour, Mark 15:33, while he was dying on the cross, and the darkness covering the land for the period of these 3 hours showed that at the moment the sixth hour struck, the pit was open. This clear sequence of the facts shows that with the gospel, and we know the sixth hour was open in 1833 with William Miller. Okay, he had the 2300 years prophecy, the three angels messages, the cleansing of the sanctuary message, for the Adventists to carry on. This clear sequence of the facts shows that with the gospel key, the good news, in other words, the teaching of the plan of salvation, the blood of Yahshua, that's your key. The good news of salvation through the shed blood of the Yahshua, that's what it says there in writing. Open to his captive people the way of the deliverance from their prison house, the bottomless pit of sin and death. Yes, we see, to recapitulate in brief, that the star is symbolical of the Yahshua, the key of the gospel, actually with the key of the gospel, that's his blood. His blood is the key to the teaching of the plan of salvation, the blood of the everlasting covenant of the Yahshua. The pit of the earth, the smoke of his sacrifice, and the darkness of the sun, and the air of the darkness that covered the world during his crucifixion. Perfect symbols. Revelation 9:3-4. And there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth, and unto them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power. And it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of the Yahweh in their forehead. When the smoke, with the smoke symbolizing the crucifixion, and the locust coming out of the smoke, the only admissible conclusion is that they are symbolical of the Christians, or the apostolic believers in Yahshua, who came as a consequence of the sacrificial blood that was shed on Calvary, and the fact that they were to hurt only those men which have not the seal of Yahweh in their forehead, makes this conclusion even more acceptable. Okay? Or even more inescapable, I mean. For only a true believer, one who has a personal experience with the Yahweh, a perfect knowledge of his word, and who is filled with his spirit, can discriminate saint from sinner. He only can recognize who has a seal and who does not have it. When the latter is cloaked in a counterfeit robe of the righteousness. For the idea that the locusts are symbolical of the Caesarean warriors is both unscriptural and illogical. For unlike the locusts, the Caesareans kill as many as opposed their way, especially did they trouble the apostolic believers, those who had the seal of Yahweh in their foreheads, and such precisely is the Satan's business that he might kill all who have the seal of Yahweh. To those, though, whom the locust represents, the restraining order was given that they should not kill, Revelation 9:5. Anyone, their business instead being to hurt only those men which have not the seal of Yahweh in their foreheads. Revelation 9:4. For this reason, also the one power, the locust, cannot symbolize the followers of the Mohammed or of any other of Satan's agents. Had the apostolic believers not been told that they should not kill, they naturally would not have known that they were entering into the period of grace. Period of grace. And so would have followed the example of the Jewish nation when, as a theocracy charged to execute Yahweh's judgment, they were commanded to kill and to drive out of the land, as was revealed by the first three trumpets, both those who were departed from him and those who did not acknowledge him as the only true Yahweh. His command, however, to the locusts that they should not kill, inaugurates a significant change in his people's dealings with his enemies. The great principle of the non-resistance enjoined in this change, Yahshua enunciated in his Sermon on the Mount. You have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you that you resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. Matthew 5:38-39. For the preaching of Yahshua and him crucified was a bitter cup to quaff for those who, because they loved sin and despised reproof, hated him and his people. For the apostolic believers consequently became a great nuisance and vexation unto their antagonists. Indeed, just as the Old and the New Testament scriptures, the two witnesses, which are the two olive trees, two prophets, Revelation 11:3-10, were so great a torment to the wicked during the 42 months, Revelation 11:2, just as the locust became so great a torment by the preaching of the gospel that both the Jews and the Romans persecuted and killed as many of them as time allowed, thus fulfilling the first woe. Just think how many were converted on the day of the Pentecost alone, about 3,000 souls, and following that, Yahshua added to the church daily such as should be saved, Acts 2:41-47. This sudden, great increase in numbers among the Christians after the crucifixion made them appear to be swarming like locusts. And two locusts can neither be frightened nor made to defend themselves under any provocation. Neither is there felt in the human heart any sorrow or pity for them, be they ever so ruthlessly killed. Yet they cannot be exterminated by the human hand. For these reasons, they are a perfect symbol of the early apostolic believers, indomitable courage and meekness in the face of the cruel oppression of them by their heartless enemies, and of the impossibility of the latter's bringing about an extinction of their Christianity. Revelation 9:7. Verse 5. And the shapes of the locusts were like unto horses prepared unto battle. Horses are prepared for battle by being well trained, a fact which in this connection manifested denotes that the early Christians swiftly and proficiently marched on the early apostolic believers swiftly and proficiently marched on with their message as horses to battle array. Revelation 9:7, second clause. And on their heads were as it were crowns like gold. Okay. So obvious as to require no interpretation, for the locusts having crowns of gold signifies their being invested with the authority pure and excellent, the authority of the Asherah, and such was exclusively the investment of the members of the early apostolic church, for the Asherah secured it unto them in his commitment. I will give unto thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatsoever thou shalt bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatsoever thou shalt loose on the earth shall be loosed in the heaven. Matthew 16:19. This brings in verse 50. Our contact is at the 11th hour call. That's number 11. Click on the audio archive. We're going to close now with a song.
Just when I need him most. Just when I need him, Yahshua is near. Just when I falter, just when I fear. Ready to help me, ready to cheer. Just when I need him most. Just when I need him most. Just when I need him most, Yahshua is near to comfort and cheer. Just when I need him most. Just when I need him, Yahshua is true, never forsaken all the way through, giving for burdens, pleasures of you, just when I need him most. Just when I need him most, just when I need him most, Yahshua is near to comfort and cheer, just when I need him most. Just when I need him, Yahshua is strong, living my burdens all the day long. For all my sorrow, giving a song, just when I need him most. Just when I need him most, just when I need him most, Yahshua is near to comfort and cheer, just when I need him most. Just when I need him, he is my home, answering when upon him I call, tenderly waiting lest I should fall. Just when I need him most, just when I need him most, just when I need him most, Yahshua is there to comfort and cheer, just when I need him